Mets fans. This is Rich Sparago, known on Twitter as CT Mets Fan or Met Fan Rich, and you are listening to the Metsian Podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And we have a very special guest on this evening, to whom I will get in just a moment. There's a lot to talk about tonight. I wish it were positive things to talk about, but unfortunately, you know, the Mets are stumbling, and we're going to get into that, and we're going to pick it apart. So with no further ado, let me first bring on my co-conspirators in podcasting. Let's see, where do you want to start today? Let's start with the man we call the CEO of podcasting operations, the man whose location is usually a mystery. So Mr. Sam Maxwell, our grand poobah of the podcast, the mastermind. And Sam, like we always start these podcasts with, where do we find you tonight?
You know, it's boring. I'm in the most amount of skyscrapers ever assembled, Manhattan. you keep wondering where I am, and I keep being in the exact same place. I'm going to have to change it up next time, I guess. Throw you a curveball.
There you go. And my fellow, my other co-conspirator in podcasting, he and I are usually in the same place. And Mike, I didn't ask you this before the show, but I'm going to assume we find you in the wonderful borough of Brooklyn, as we usually do. So is that correct? And how are you tonight?
Yes, indeed. And I'm doing well. Got my second shot. So, you know, it kind of got me a little bit, kicked me in the butt. Otherwise, I'm excited to talk Mets baseball. Hello, Sam, and hello, Metsville.
Very good. And as I mentioned, we have a very special guest with us tonight. There is a lot to break down, and nobody better to do it with than our special guest, and that is Mr. Justin Toscano. Justin is the Mets beat writer for The Record and NorthJersey.com, and they are part of the USA Today network. Justin grew up in San Diego. Maybe Justin could tell us what it's like being on the East Coast now. So he grew up in San Diego and graduated from Arizona State. And you could follow him on Twitter at Justin C. Toscano. Let me say that again, at Justin C. Toscano. He's a voice that you hear. His is a voice that you hear every day when you're watching the Mets pre- and post-game shows. So, Justin, thank you very much for joining us tonight. How are you doing, sir?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, guys. Always happy to do it, and I'm excited to talk some baseball with you guys.
Awesome. Thank you. And so, Justin, I'm going to pose the first question to you, and then typically what we do is we wheel it around, but I'd like you to answer first, if you don't mind. And we have to start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Right.
The Mets are, you know, we thought they'd have a good season, and they still very well may, but at this point, 19 games into the season, they're 9-10. They're coming off a sweep, a two-game sweep at the hands of the Red Sox at Citi Field, a sweep in which the Mets scored a grand total of one run on a home run by Jeff McNeil. They had nine total hits. Sure, you know, we could say the Red Sox pitched well, and I'm sure they did, but let's not lose sight of the fact that Garrett Richards had an ERA over six going into the game, and Nick Pivetta, his ERA going into the game was 3.48. The Mets know him. They've seen him. This guy isn't Cy Young. All right, I'll stop there before I get carried away. So, Justin, what are your thoughts at this point? Can you just – why do you think they're 9-10? They're not hitting, but what's going on with this team?
Well, they could be – I mean, I guess I'll wrap my answer with this later on, but it could be a lot worse than 9-10. Right now, look, the most concerning part for me is that first week and then through the stops and starts, they were creating a lot of these scoring opportunities and just weren't driving runners in. That was a problem in 2020, but you think like, hey, it's got to turn sometime, right? Like they'll get the big knock here and there, string together a couple, you know, crooked numbers and it'll be all be fine. That wasn't so these past couple days. They didn't even string together a lot of those scoring opportunities. And to me, that was the most concerning part. If you look at this team, that now you've got names in a lineup like Francisco Lindor, Pete Alonso, Mike Conforto, Jeff McNeil, all in the same lineup. They were expected to be one of the best offenses in baseball, and to this point, they've been the opposite, you know, maybe the worst, and certainly the worst if you look at certain categories. But I think what was most concerning to me was what I mentioned with the past couple games is just the lack of an efficient or effective approach. And Luis Rojas said they were really in between, not committing one way or the other. And then they really look lost. Like, I know baseball has an opportunity to make you slip up into some recency bias just because it's daily and there's a ton of games. But I'm like sitting here and I still can't remember a game in which I saw so many silly swings as the one I did yesterday. Like, it was bad. And like you mentioned, like, Red Sox pitching, their lineup's good, very good, but the pitching, like, the Mets should not be getting shut down by Red Sox pitching. And I think why they are, like, the first couple weeks, they weren't hitting with runners in scoring position. This last week, I mean, a lot of times they've just been quiet on all fronts. Like, you can even go back to the game against Joe Ross. And it's that all-too-familiar storyline that I get, like, fans are frustrated because you're getting these, like, right, it's big league pitching. They're good. They're there for a reason. But these guys aren't Cy Young Award winners, and the Mets are making mediocre pitchers look like frontline starters. And so from that perspective, I get all the fan anger, frustration, all of it, all the angst, the anxiety among the fan base. But I think, God, if you look at it from, like, glass half full, I guess it could be a lot worse. Like, if their starting pitching wasn't good, you know, hadn't been good, and if their bullpen hadn't, you know, really come around in the past couple weeks, oh, they'd be a lot worse than 9-10. But it's like, on one hand, I want to say it's only April, but, you know, you're 19 games in, these games count just the same, and it's like they've given fans little reason to think they'll turn this around pretty soon. Like, there were no signs of life in that Boston series, and I just think the most concerning part is just the lack of a, I want to say, effective approach. I mean, it just, no one looked like they knew what they were doing last night, especially.
Exactly. And to emphasize your point, the Mets right now sit at 187 with runners in scoring position. And I agree, it wasn't so much runners in scoring position in the most recent series because they didn't get anybody on base. But 187 with runners in scoring position as of this moment, which is clearly last in baseball. But Justin, before I go to Sam and Mike, I want to touch on something you said. And you are a perfect person to give insight on this. And I just want to hear it from a professional writer. Okay. You mentioned the inconsistent, you know, the COVID with the beginning of the season with Washington, the rainouts and all this kind of stuff. Okay, fine. Can you tell us from your perspective, being around the team, is that inconsistency, do you think, is a contributing factor to what we're seeing offensively? Or, because I'll tell you right now, a lot of the fans roll their eyes when they hear that. They're sick of hearing it, but I want your perspective. You come from a different perspective. Do you think that is significantly or even moderately impacting the offensive malaise?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, I know I don't, you know, I'm trying to dodge the tomatoes right now because I know fans, like, they just do not want to hear that. And I totally get it because, like, I understand it. Like, when you're watching a team like that and you're watching 3-4 hours of a game and it's, like, the same stuff all over again and then you just hear, like, well, like, you know, like, these guys haven't taken BP or what. Like, I get it. I totally get it. It just seems like a load of excuses. But, yeah, like, when – come on. I mean, when you get so amped up to face a guy like Max Scherzer and then you spend the weekend looking through Oculus goggles and doing VR stuff instead, virtual reality stuff instead, and you don't get to play until Philly, and then you've got that week with, you know, 3 rainouts or whatever it was, and then, the snow out even, and then, like – and then even this week, they got unlucky with 2 off days that, you know, they just really didn't need because they need to string together some games right now. I definitely think it's a contributing factor, especially with the weather when you're not hitting. I mean, you can hit in the cage, but it's certainly not the same as taking BP outside. So I do think it's a contributing factor. Now, the qualifier there and the obvious one is, like, this lineup, I mean, it's not a fringe, you know, middle of the pack. I mean, this lineup is one of the most talented, you know, on paper in baseball, or so it looked coming in, you know, during spring training. So I think the talent should really be pulling a lot more weight here. You think they would have run into some more power, certainly, and maybe, you know, that helps them put some crooked numbers up. So that's the thing. Like, from, I do think it's really screwed with their rhythm, the stops and starts. Like, I do, I mean, it's just, I obviously don't know that for a fact, but because it's tough to just speculate on that. But I especially at the big league level, it's pretty tough. And they need to get into a rhythm, and I would assume it's difficult to do that. So I buy into that narrative a little more because I do try to be understanding of maybe what they're going through. And maybe that's because I have to cover them. Look, like I said, I get it. Like, fans are frustrated. They deserve to be frustrated. Like, they deserve to be able to feel however they want. And I get that when you're, like, just watching the game, watching TV, and, you know, 10:30 at night, you just hear the same old spiel, and it just seems like a load of excuses. Like, I get that. But I do think it's contributed because they've played, you know, probably the most abnormal schedule in baseball to this point. I do think it'll turn, you know, when they start stringing together games and getting into the meat of the schedule. But, you know, to this point, that's been like a big if, and now we're going to see if they can, because after, I think the next off day is like May 10th or something after today. So they're going to start getting into swing here. But I do think it's a real issue that can prohibit a team from really getting into a rhythm. But it, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say like that doesn't take the entire lineup off the hook for being cold at the same time for 3 weeks, you know, with the exception of Brandon Nimmo and JD Davis.
Thank you for the perspective. I really do appreciate it. And I think our listeners do too, because the people are listening to this podcast, they're pretty diehard Mets fans. And yes, at 10:30 at night is when we roll our eyes and say, we don't want to hear the same spiel. So thank you for having context. all right. Same question, Sam, going to you. They're 9-10, and you know, let's keep Justin's words in mind. I guess he's right. It could be worse when you're hitting 187 with runners in scoring position. I suppose it could be worse than 9-10. So what's your perspective on the 800-pound gorilla in the room?
Well, it's funny. Ironically, that was going to be my question to Justin about the schedule and the fact that they got all the rainouts and snowouts and COVID outs and all these things, and then all of a sudden they have 2 days off just randomly. But what I was thinking about last night was like sitting there, I was basically hoping, and you guys will remember this, when Yoannis Cespedes, I think it was 2016, when they were down like 3-0 to the Cubs, and Cespedes just hit a third decker that just completely woke up the crowd. And I was just thinking about how last night, even though it was 1-0, like that's what they needed, and they didn't have that. And I guess if I was going to like pose any question to Justin right now, was I was sitting there thinking, like, who is going to be that guy? And I guess, who do you think needs to be the guy? You know, because that's what Cespedes at his best, as sour as we were by the end of it, you know, that him at his best could just be that supercharge that would jolt the entire stadium and team up. Like, who – obviously, I guess the answer – you know, the obvious answer is Lindor, but right now, like, who do you think is going to be that in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I was actually going to say the obvious answer to my eye is Alonso, just because I think with the natural power he has, like Lindor, you're right because of the superstardom, but I would say Alonso, just because I think, I mean, it just goes back to like what he did in 2019, what he means to the team, the fan base, the franchise. And I think it just blends so well with the natural power that I think, like, he's the guy in that lineup. Like, they've got a lot of great bats and a lot of guys who can run into some power, but he's the guy with the most natural power. The guy you can say, you know, like, when this team is sleepwalking throughout 5, 6, 7, 7 and 2/3, whatever it may be, he's the guy who can change the game, change the storyline, change the narrative with one swing. And I think he's hit five, six home runs right by, you know, at this point. He's struggled otherwise. He's struck out a lot, which, you know, has been very surprising. But I think he's the guy that they're going to need to lean on because, I mean, I know he's still young, but, you know, he's got the most power. He's going to be hitting, you know, third in that lineup. And I just think with so many of his teammates struggling, and then, you know, like Michael Conforto's coming around, but others are just really mightily struggling, and especially Dom Smith and Francisco Lindor trying to, see a ball or two fall into the outfield. I think it's got to be Pete Alonso to me. Like, I think, you know, just not only because he has the power in his bat, but the personality, I think, has, you know, he's the guy that, that can provide that spark just because he can change the game with one swing. And I think he, you know, they're going to need him in Philadelphia, you know, especially as you guys know, it gets wacky here. Like, I feel like every time they, you know, they play here and we're watching games at Citizens Bank, you know, Park, you know, either it's a bullpen meltdown, something else, like things get wacky. They're going to need some stable presence. And I think, you know, it's high time for Pete Alonso to come around a little bit more.
And can I also, before I send it back over to you, Rich, mention, speaking of Philadelphia, and I believe the final score was about 16-8 or 16-9 when they were down with Jacob deGrom on the mound, and then David Wright coming back for the first time in a long time in 2015 struck a home run that lit up Philadelphia.
Yeah, it's like, look, like one swing can do it. Like, as stupid as that sounds, like baseball is just such a weird sport where, like, you know, like one play, one swing, one home run kind of changes the course. And I think Pete Alonso, just to me, has the most natural power, is that guy that really, especially on the road, can hit that bomb that really silences the crowd, that no doubter that, you know, lands on Mars the next morning kind of thing, like the Wrigley Field one that literally landed on the street outside the ballpark. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting, but I just think, like, yeah, the obvious candidate, like you said, being Lindor because he's a star, but I just, you know, he hasn't really showcased great power to this point in the season. I mean, he's had a couple hard flyouts, but a lot of grounders lately, and, you know, I think Alonso has got to be that guy. It's just a matter of, as I mentioned, you know, not striking out as much, which has kind of been the surprising part with him after the spring he had.
Very good. Sam, are you good?
I am great, Justin. Thank you.
Mike. Thank you, Justin. Mike, we'll go to you. You've watched 19 games. Your thoughts on what's going on and why the malaise?
Rich, and hello, Justin. Glad to be speaking with you. A 9-10 record definitely speaks of inconsistency, and the weather is definitely a contributing factor. But we got problems, Rich. We got real problems. All right. The Mets are 2-6 since we last spoke about them so glowingly after the Rockies series. Look what they did to Jacob DeGrom's gem. They sandwiched it in between a sweep by the Cubs and a sweep by the Red Sox. Okay? Over those 8 games, they got outscored 33-20. Look what happened against the Red Sox. They had 60 at-bats in 2 games and struck out 28 times. That's almost half. Their last – now, granted, they have about 4 or 5 less – or fewer games played, but they're last in the National League in runs, home runs, slugging, OPS, and total bases. So, you know, I like trends. You know, as I say, once is an event, twice is a coincidence, 3 times is a trend. We now have trends to speak of. It's unfortunate that they didn't get off to a better start. As you know, Rich, you can't win pennants in April, but you sure can lose them. Now, a 9-10 isn't devastating. To keep this in context, look at the rest of the division. Braves are on top with a 12-12 record. Then there's us and the Phillies, 1 game under 500. You know, so there's a lot of teams in this present state and condition. But, you know, we're not interested in them. We're interested in the Mets. And there's a real big problem when Jacob DeGrom is your leading hitter. He's batting .462, 6 hits and 13 at bat, you know, and 2 runners and 2 hits with runners in scoring position, or 2 RBIs with runners in scoring. When he's leading your list, that's a problem. Now, do I think they're going to break out of this funk? Yeah. On the other side, there's going to be a stretch where they're going to, you know, hit off the charts, but that remains to be seen. For the moment, in the month of April, this is what we're left with.
And that is a great segue to my next question, and I'll start with you again, Justin. So as Mike said, it's not a little thing. You know, there are some problems here. You know, it's not one stat that's out of whack. Everything's out of whack. And sure, you know, you have to believe, you know, use a cliche, the back of the baseball card thing, and they'll come around and all that. Okay, fine. But here's my question for you, being close to the team. The fans are screaming for Chili Davis. They're saying, you know, they're hitting too many ground balls. That's Chili Davis's approach. You know, he's not a big launch angle guy, and he, you know, the team has not produced offensively the last two seasons. Yes, last year he was on Zoom, and now he's with the team. So the question is a two-part question for you, Justin. Number one, is that real? Is Chili Davis in any kind of jeopardy here to be a fall guy for the team's offensive woes? And then I'm going to back that up with my other question. Luis Rojas has now had 79 games, basically half a season, which isn't a big body of work. But we were talking about before the show, in 2018, the Mets had a good second half, particularly good August and September. They looked alive. You know, they played better baseball. Okay, fine. 2019, post-All-Star break, that team was jumping. That team, you know, was energized and playing crisp baseball and all this stuff. My opinion, since Luis Rojas has taken over for 2020 and 79 games into his tenure, this team has been deader than a doornail for that entire time. And my next question, so Chili Davis, number one, do you think that because Sandy wanted Rojas back, you know, he made that pretty clear, that Rojas has carte blanche this year, nothing's going to happen? Or do you think that there's a point at which they might say, look, we're way below expectations, it's time for a change? So if you don't mind running with those two questions.
Yeah, so number one, you know, it's tough because I don't even think, like, the people who covered the game, like I wouldn't lie to you guys and say that I know the exact points of, like, the effect a hitting coach has, right? Like, to me, a hitting coach, you've got to be there to harp on approach, to help guys, you know, with their swings, things like that. But it's almost like in the big leagues, like, come on. Like, Francisco Lindor isn't not hitting because of Chili Davis. You know what I mean? Like, I think that part is tough because these guys aren't high school guys. They're not college guys. These are professional hitters that are talented, that are there for a reason, especially in this lineup. And guys with track records, like you mentioned, the back of the baseball card. But then you get to the other side of this, which is the coaches, you know, specifically those assistant coaches always seem to be the scapegoats. Like, we saw it with Dave Island in, you know, 2019. There were a lot of people that thought, you know, he shouldn't have been fired and things like that. So it's with that bullpen's bad start. But I don't think, you know, right now I think it's just far too soon, especially because, you know, Zach Scott has talked about evaluating the organization as a whole. Chili Davis was back even after the season he spent on Zoom. So I think another big thing, too, is that the players seem to love him. Like, you know, they really seem to like him and appreciate how he personalizes kind of his style to them and gets to know them. So I don't think there's any real concern there yet in terms of his job security. But, I mean, like, you know, anything can happen. They're performing way below expectations. So, like, if you ask me in 4 weeks if this continued and you ask me the same question, like, the answer might be completely different. And then for your second question, yeah, I don't think, I'll preface with a lot of bad things can happen over 162 games. So I don't want to say, like, Luis Rojas would never be fired, but I just don't, you know, I don't see it happening, especially with this being the last year on his deal. He's got an option for next year that they obviously don't have to pick up if they don't want to. And then, like I just mentioned, Zach Scott saying that he was kind of more focused on conducting a thorough review of the organization, its members, its parts, how things are working, the processes. Luis has some runway. I think he should. Like, I know a lot of fans are upset, you know, with the job he's done, or maybe, you know, like you said, I mean, I think a lot of people think that he's not fired up enough to be in the job he, you know, he is. Maybe he's too cool, calm, and collected is what some of the fans think, and some of the stuff I've seen on social media. Like, I, you know, so I get the frustration. And you made a good point. Like, since 2019, that second half, like, this team has looked like a corpse of that team. Like, and it hasn't been close. But I think a lot of Luis Rojas' tenure to this point has been spent dealing with a bad pitching staff. Like, last year, that was an awful pitching staff. Yes, the offensive issues persisted, but I do think that would have been a different season had the Mets been able to rely on their pitching, and not even as much as they are now, but just, like, if they had had a solid pitching staff. I just don't see Luis Rojas being fired midseason. And I mean, I like I said, I guess anything can happen. I guess they could lose 25 straight. I mean, nothing's out of, you know, play in baseball, but it's like, unless something ridiculous happened, like I couldn't see it, because I think I also don't think there's a benefit to that. They've built a core. It's not like their window is closed with the Francisco, like with the core they have, and then the Lindor extension. Like, they should theoretically on paper compete for, you know, years if they do things right, especially with Cohen, you know, wanting to infuse more capital into the team and its budget and whatnot. So I don't think the window is, you know, closing or anything, which is why I just don't think there's a ton of pressure to make a move. And I think a lot of times when these moves are made and a team gets an interim, like, it might have the opposite effect in terms of just, like, you know, that the team thinks its season is over, like, yada, yada. And I just don't really think I don't think the Mets would want to go that direction, especially because this is the last year of Rojas's contract. It's not like he would be a lame duck, you know, next year.
That's kind of what I expected. And also, I think Sandy Alderson factors into that too. I think he likes to run kind of a steady ship. And I know rumor is that he was close to firing Terry Collins once, and that was stopped. But it's just not his style. You know, he's not the I don't want to use the word impulsive, it's only one I can come up with, kind of a GM where, you know, he's given to do that kind of thing. So all right, so I'll send it over to you, Sam. Your thoughts on Chili Davis? Is there any accountability there? And Luis Rojas?
Well, you know, I do want to point out, to be contrarian, that he did get thrown out. I think it was somewhere in Wrigley. He did get thrown out of the game and did show a little bit of fire at that point. And I really did like it, even though I don't think the Mets ended up winning that game, of course. But I think that, you know, as we were going through all of that, I was just thinking about how, you know, far away 2015 is, yet so close at the same time. Thinking about it from the context of 2019, we're talking about a team that went from making the World Series and losing it because they really, you know, let a lot of opportunities go, to that manager going, the GM unfortunately having to step away, and, you know, a new manager who couldn't put them into the playoffs as good as they looked at the end of 2019. And now, of course, with the COVID year, the Wilpons are out. So when I'm looking at the job that I see Luis Rojas doing, I do think about the fact that he's still in his late 30s. I don't even think he's 40 yet. And the fact that I've wanted a little bit more consistency, I've wanted to give somebody breathing room, give somebody a chance without us freaking out all the time. Even though I haven't, you know, I think we've certainly seen some growing pains. But at the same time, you know, I hope he has his father's ear. I mean, excuse me. I hope that he listens to his father. He has the ear, to his father's lips when it comes to, managing, Felipe Alou being his father. And he absorbs some of that wisdom, even though it's a new world, and a new way of managing. And some people think that they're not really even managing at all, but, you know, I can't say exactly what's going on between the dynamic of the dugout and up there. But, you know, specifically with Chili Davis, I think something will give. You can't have performance. Last night is what we were talking about when we had Eric Campbell and John Mayberry Jr. in the middle of the lineup. That's what they looked like, and that wasn't the type of players, like Justin says, on paper that they should be. So, you know, something will have to give at some point. And, yeah, you know, unfortunately, he's probably going to have to get scapegoated if we continue to see this going, because like we've said, everybody else has kind of seemed to come together. And last night was just one of those games, quintessential Mets type of games, where you get the pitching that you need, especially, you know, if we're talking about Jacob DeGrom, which that kind of, you know, all of a sudden the brilliance of him gets sidetracked because of how inept everything else is. So when it comes to Jacob DeGrom, yet again we see somebody who doesn't even have his best stuff last night and is taking on a Red Sox team with a crazy good offense, but still manages to, you know, give a lot of pitches and only give up one run. And yet again, it's depressing. It looked like with Jacob DeGrom, things had started to change in terms of getting the runs, even though he was partially the reason why those runs were being produced. But it looks like yet again, you know, today was front and center. Just as great as the last start was, this was the complete opposite and the complete, the exact everything in a bubble as to what has been wrong with wasting the one of the greatest pitchers in a generation, his time here. And we not only do we need to get him a ring, but we need to stop wasting gems like last night.
Amen to that. So, Mike, same question. As you look at this, do you think it's just fan reaction to say fire Chili Davis, or do you think maybe there could be something to that? And if you could comment on the body of work of Luis Rojas.
Gladly. Like Sam was saying, you know, it's ponderous that DeGrom has 188 career starts and he only has 72 victories. But Rich, you know me. If there's a problem with the manager, I look at the general manager. If you have a problem with the general manager, I look at the owner. I'm always looking upwards. Because why? Stuff rolls downhill. So my answer to this all is really a question I'm going to phrase for Justin. We've mentioned Zach Scott. We've brought up Sandy Alderson. His front office and their implementation of analytics, this robotic approach at the plate, concerning or overly concerned with launch angle, et cetera, et cetera. Insofar as the art of hitting, trying to manufacture runs, plate and count adaptability, shortening swings, taking pitches the other way, hitting against the shift, you know, is the age of the walk, bunt, stolen base, sack fly over? Is it dead at Citi Field? And this question was partly inspired by Jeff Cohen, our friend over at Baseball and Barbecue. He tweeted us earlier this afternoon. But I'm just as curious to see what you say about this, Justin. Is Luis Rojas, in fact, authorized to go off script and manufacture and be artful in his craft?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's always hard to tell just because I think there was one of you mentioned, I think it was Sam who mentioned that, like, these days front office really does control a lot, and maybe not even control a lot, as it's more of just a collaborative effort, whereas it used to just be, you know, the manager, like you said, doing his own thing, kind of implementing, you know, putting his own mark, his own fingerprints on the game. You know, I think Luis Rojas can. I think they want to be collaborative. They've given him that leeway. But in terms of your question about analytics, yeah, that's always a concern, right? I think Francisco Lindor said it when talking about defense, like how he felt that it was just too much. You know, the analytical side of the game is just too much now, and how it's taken away from the freedom that players have. Which, yeah, like that should be a legitimate concern because, yeah, sometimes it does look robotic. Maybe it does, you know, take a little bit of the natural feel of the game away from hitters and the batter's box. But I think, I mean, Zach Scott's got a very analytical background. I think they're all striving for the same thing, right? I think they all love the game, and I think they all want to implement these analytics in a way that gives them a strategic advantage without taking the feel, because the feel of the game and freedom of the players to play is what's really going to make you ball games or win you ball games. And I think make you contenders, because I think at least in my view in sports, talent, you know, wins most times. Players win games. Talent wins games. And so I think, look, I don't think anybody's lost sight of that, but I do think there is a concern in baseball among fans, and I think it's valid because, I mean, we're all baseball fans, that, you know, analytics becomes too much. But I see it as a way for the Mets, especially because of how much they've beefed it up, to contend and implement a lot of this stuff. And it just really comes down to how you apply it. A lot of these teams, it's almost like an arms race, and now, you know, a lot of them have the same technology, have the same programs, the same systems, but it's about how you apply it. And I think, for example, like, their positioning has gotten a lot better defensively. Like, they've been in a lot better position to make plays on hard liners or whatever it may be, and that's thanks to analytical formulas and just more manpower on that end. And I know their data engineering structure, you know, is a lot better than it was a year ago. And same with the baseball analytics department as a whole. But I do think Luis Rojas is able to, you know, to go off script to do what, you know, what he wants. It doesn't seem like he's got his hands tied completely. But then, you know, I say that with the caveat that these days it's just a different game than it was 10, 15 years ago. It's more collaborative, where the front office does have more of a say, you know, in things than they ever have before. But I don't really think it doesn't give me the vibe that it's as controlling as it was, you know, with the previous regime. But yeah, and then I guess I know it wasn't part of the question, but I think Sam brought up a good point that consistency with Luis Rojas, I think, is a big thing, because look, when he's still a young guy, still learning the job. I mean, he knows how to manage. He managed in the Dominican Winter League. And I think if you can manage in the Dominican Winter League, which is known for, you know, the fan outbursts and the outrage in the towns, you know, if the team doesn't play well, I think he can handle Mets Twitter and like what Mets fans will give him. I just think it's a matter of like consistency. And I think that's going to be the big thing going forward, is like if the Mets can get some consistency in that seat. But like you said, I mean, there's always the worry that like the manager can't really even put his fingerprints on a game. I don't know if we've seen enough to see that yet with the new regime.
Mike, are you good on this question?
You know what? Before you recycle this thing, Rich, Justin, you said a magic word, Mets Twitter. Is that a real thing? Explain to me your perception of Mets Twitter.
My perception. Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I grew up on the West Coast. I mean, before I got this job, never even knew what Mets Twitter was. I think it is. I mean, I see enough stuff swirling around that, you know, stuff that can't be printed, can't be repeated. You probably shouldn't show kids under, you know, 15 years old, but it's, yeah, it's definitely a real thing. As funny as it is, like, I know, you know, like, players know what Twitter is and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think Luis Rojas cares. He's, you know, don't think he's on Twitter, but, yeah, Mets Twitter is a real thing. And my perception is, yeah, a lot of times I leave the app, you know, like shaking my head at, I don't know how things like this come to mind for some people, but hey, do your thing.
Take it away.
Yeah,
Rich.
There was one particular GIF today that I saw that I was just like, I think I understand what you're saying, but I'm just, this is what? Huh?
That's funny.
Yeah. It's, Yeah. A lot of times, you know, I'm just sitting there during the games and things will get retweeted onto my timeline. And I just, like I said, I would, you know, one part of me wishes I could spend, you know, an hour in these people's heads. But another part of me is like, you know, I'd probably be scarred for the rest of my life. So it's, but hey, like, I think I always qualify when people ask me about Mets fans and Mets Twitter. I'd rather have passion than indifference. And that's always that, you know, that's always going to be my line. Like, maybe it's, you know, I mean, you don't want, you know, as long as slurs and things like that aren't involved, but, you know, passion is always better than indifference. And I think, you've got it with this fan base. So that's like, that's the first start. If the fans don't care, then it's a wash, right?
That's so wonderful.
Yeah.
So you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And tonight we're thrilled to have a very special guest, Justin Toscano, who is a beat writer for The Record and NorthJersey.com, and they are part of the USA Today network. So we've talked about the Mets collectively. Justin, I'm going to start with you one more time here. I'd like to talk about one player in particular whose name has come up several times already, and that's Francisco Lindor. Look, you know, it's 1 month into what will be probably an 11-year career with the Mets, so it's a little early to get crazy. But he hasn't looked good, and that's clear. I think we can all agree on that. His last bat last night, he scalded the ball and just hit in bad luck. Okay, and Rojas commented on that after the game. That could be the swing that gets him going. But my question for you, Justin, and ultimately for Sam and Mike, is it just one of those things? And I know in the past that he has had some slower starts. Is it just one of those things, or do you think there's something more to it? Is he feeling the pressure of the contract? Is he feeling the pressure of New York? Or perhaps is he feeling the adjustment to the National League, a more on-the-field thing? So if you can run with Lindor, please, that would be great.
Right, yeah. I was actually, talking to somebody about a week ago, and they were just telling me, you know, just about how somebody's followed him for his career, his entire career, and they were just telling me about how, you know, they were just made the point that, you know, fans, whether it be Cleveland fans or now Mets fans, always get into, you know, a ruckus when he starts slow and then he finishes the year hitting 280 with, you know, X amount of bombs and it's all fine. I do think it's probably just the first month of April, slow start sort of thing, you know, like we talked about, not a lot of time to get into a rhythm. He's looked great defensively, so that's one thing I keep my eye on personally, because I think, you know, like in basketball, it's like if your shots aren't falling, are you still playing good defense? Like him, you know, like he's not hitting well, but he's still in the field. He's still the same Francisco Lindor. I know he did make an error in Chicago, but on the field, you know, 90, you know, he's still the same Francisco Lindor. And to me, that's a good sign. I don't see any bad body language out there. You know, it doesn't seem like he's got a bad attitude out there. I think more than like the National League game, I think that's certainly a factor. And it's Luis Rojas mentioned that just as something that, you know, needs to be adjusted to. And he was talking about that yesterday. But I think more than anything, like I try to put myself in his shoes. And, you know, like you go from playing in Cleveland and you're the guy in Cleveland, though, and now you're the guy in New York, and you signed this huge contract, and, you know, you've got to move into your new place, start the season. No, by the way, you know, there's COVID outs, rain out, snow out. And so I just think it's just like that weird transitional period where it's still really early. And I know spring training doesn't matter, but he looked great at the plate there. So that, to me, tells me that it's still the same guy. I think it's just a slow start to the season, new team, new game, you know, with the National League. So I'm not really too concerned from that perspective. I don't really think nothing I've seen has given me the reason to believe that he's just struggling with the pressure of living up to that contract. Now, on the flip side of things, I think fans are so frustrated even through 19 games because he signed that contract. Like if he, you know, I mean, there would no way be the outrage there is right now, at least on social media or even in, you know, the stands, you know, booing him, you know, if he hadn't signed that contract or if he'd signed for far less than he did. But look, when you make $341 million over, and I know it's deferred, so over, I'll just say over the next 11 years, going to make $363 million. Expectations are high, naturally, as they should be. But I don't think he's given me no reason to believe that he's struggling with the pressure of that contract. In fact, I think he enjoys probably being in the spotlight more. He's a guy who, you know, he loves fashion, he loves the arts, he loves being in the spotlight, not because he likes the attention, but I think he's just equipped to handle it. I don't really think he cares. He's more of the free and easygoing type that doesn't look to me like New York is putting him in a blender and then really like squeezing. Like I don't see that from him at all. Like the New York market is a pressure cooker, as the cliche goes, but I just don't really, you know, I don't think he cares about any of that. I think he knows how good he is. His teammates love him. Everybody's praised his work ethic. And like I said, the body language to me has been fine. Like he's been annoyed after at bats, you know, in the dugout, but defensively, like he's still been the same guy. And that tells me that for him, there's really nothing, you know, like obviously he's probably frustrated, but there's nothing going on mentally that's going to be permanently like detrimental to this guy. Like, I think it's going to be something where we look back even in a couple months and laugh at kind of this happening.
I hope so. So I'll take from your that the, and from what I've seen with my own two eyes in his conference, the booing does not seem to get to him. I think he said it, you know, it's just the reaction of a passionate crowd and I have to be better, which as Gary Cohen said during the broadcast is probably the perfect answer for New York. Just take accountability. Don't fire back at the fans. Take accountability. And that's what we want to hear. That's, you know, we're all fans of, you know, various teams and various sports. And that's basically what the mentality of the fan is. And if a player takes accountability and says, look, I'm trying to be better. No, nobody's ever going to have an issue with that. It's when you fire back at them, you know, the Lee Elia line of, you know, what was that line about 95% of the world is employed and the other 5% goes to Cubs game. You know, you don't want to be saying stuff like that, but that's one of the best lines of all time when they ask why the fans are going to Cubs. But anyway, Sam, we'll go to you next on this one. Your observations on Lindor.
I don't know if I've ever heard that one. I'm going to have to loop back around and write that down somewhere. That's great. Justin finished with it with about the defense. I mean, you know, if there's anything that has made me say, oh, man, I'm still happy that the way the trade went down with the players that left coming here, you can see, I mean, I feel like regardless of what Andrés Giménez was able to give you defensively out there, Francisco Lindor just brings just this other attitude behind the pitcher in heading towards the outfield behind him. You know, and we've seen that with SNY has employed that angle of that medium close up of Francisco Lindor with a runner on second and the pitcher. And I believe there was actually a play where he lined it out recently where he was out right at second base. Now, this was right. What ironically is that the same people in Citi Field that watch him make that play then booed him, some of them, then booed him when he made an out later on, when he made a strikeout. And I just think that, you got to, like, take it easy. Like, there's nobody hitting right now. Why are we – like, I understand that he's going to get the ire of the Met fans because he's the one through all of this that should be coming through. But I just don't think we need to be doing that because I think we're better than that. And I like this guy too much. So take it easy. Stop comparing him sensationally to Jason Bay already. And let's slow it down, even though, Rich, of course, we're Jason Bay enthusiasts over here.
You and I always were, you know, and I'll say something about that real quick. The reason I was, and no, Sam, maybe you could say why you were, to me, I have no problem with any player in any sport who is clearly busting his butt. If the guy doesn't succeed, it's something I could never do. You can't fault this guy for not succeeding. Just bust your butt. And Jason Bay always did, and I never understood why people booed that guy. Never. To me, the only reason to come down on any player, particularly one on your own team, is if you sense a lack of effort, a la Ruben Tejada. Did I say that out loud? Yeah, I think I did. But in the time that Terry Collins even got on him a couple of times. But those are the guys who irk me. Guys like Jason Bay, I was at the game at Dodger Stadium when he basically knocked his own head off his shoulders going into the wall to catch a ball and ended up with a concussion. The guy was absolutely, you know, his heart was in the right place. But anyway. All right, so Mike, your thoughts on Lindor?
It's kind of funny. Fan rage, Mets Twitter, a lot of that needs to be put through the translator, which I don't think a lot of people downloaded that app. But Lindor, you know, he's earned the benefit of the doubt. Not everyone can jump out in front like Gary Carter did when he came to the Mets. Let's not forget Carlos Beltran's first season with the Mets. He struggled mightily. You know, but insofar, look, there's only three things that fans can do collectively together at a baseball game. That's sing at the seventh inning stretch, cheer, and boo. And that's why I cycle back. You got to put a lot of this through the translator. It's one of the ways that fans can get their message across simply, easily, and collectively. Boo! It means a lot. You have to put it through the translator. And here in New York, we do that. Sam knows I have this unscientific aversion to Central Division players. We heard it from Lindor's mouth himself. He's never got booed before. Welcome to New York City.
It is part of it. And I'm encouraged by what Justin said, that he doesn't see anything deeper. Like, it's not Lindor, you know, saying, doing the Ed Whitson, right? You know, can't deal with New York kind of a thing. It's not that. It's just guy's a slow starter. And he has been in the past. And it's likely nothing more than that.
And it goes
all
back
right,
to,
so we have,
you mentioned Ed Whitson. It goes back to Jack McDowell as well. It goes back that far.
Right. Absolutely. Remember when Steve Summers called him the digital unit after he gave the finger to him?
Yeah.
That's one of the best Steve Summers. Steve Summers had many great lines. That's one of them. All right. So you are listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and we're thrilled to be talking baseball with Justin Toscano of the Record of NorthJersey.com. And Justin, writer for the Record and NorthJersey.com. So, Justin, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself at this point? Such as, you know, where people can find your work in addition to those two publications. And maybe you could dive into this thing about San Diego. What made you migrate 3,000 miles east?
Yeah, sure. So, my Twitter is Justin C. Toscano, and you can find my work there and NorthJersey.com. And we've got a couple good subscription deals going. It's pretty cheap. I know, like, I get it, like, times are tough, but would really appreciate that if, you know, if people want to catch up on everything. We've got a lot of good subscriber-only things, especially for Mets, you know, planned that I won't, you know, get into a lot of specifics, but we do a lot of – I try to get a lot of exclusive things and interviews for that. And then in terms of San Diego, so I grew up in San Diego, went to Arizona State. It was pretty good journalism school. I wanted to go – it's funny because Arizona State gets, like, a bad rap and, like, you know, I went there for 4 years, so, like, deservedly so with some of the – a fraction of the student body. But it was good journalism school. I liked it. But, yeah, I migrated out here just to – look, I mean, if somebody offers you a job to cover, you know, a team in New York, I mean, that's pretty much kind of the big time. Like, I still love it back home. It'll always be home. But, like, for me, it was, you know, cool to get the opportunity, and I've enjoyed learning a new market more than anything, because I think, like, when I first got here, it's tough to see how people can care about sports so much. And that's coming from a guy who was, like, a sports nut growing up. And the one in high school, everybody, that's how everybody knew me in high school, is like the sports nut, like, guy who loves sports. And then you get here and it's like, you guys said, like, people are booing, people are, you know, like, nasty comments here and there. It's like they live and die by how the Mets do every year. And I think that's a really cool thing, because, like I said, I mean, passion is just so much better than indifference. But yeah, it's been quite the adjustment. Like, not homesick wise, I don't really get homesick. Like I said, I love it back home. I just don't get homesick because I do like New York, but it's a little cold for a couple months there, and the winter was a little long this year, so I'd appreciate it if you native New Yorkers could kind of, like, slow that roll a little bit next year, because I don't want to be wearing, you know, winter jackets into March next year.
Yeah, I mean, some of the coldest days I've ever had in my life, and I've been to obviously many football games. Opening day at Shea, Justin. Opening day at Shea in 1985, when Gary Carter hit the walk-off. I mean, just game time temperature was probably in the high 30s with a howling wind, and you sit there for 5 hours.
Oh,
and the next,
God.
Oh, and opening day 2011. I'll never forget this. Opening day 2011 at Citi Field. It was Good Friday, and it was just bone-chilling cold. I remember going to the concession stand. You got to get a laugh out of this thing. I'm, like, shivering. Can I please have a coffee? And they're like, we don't have any coffee. We ran out. It's opening day. How can you run out of anything? It's the first game of 81, you know. But there have been some rough times. Baseball.
The Wilpons, everybody. The Wilpons.
There you go. All right. So, and by the way,
Rich, I just want to say, since you said Good Friday, I thought you said concession stand, not concession stand.
Concession. Getting all
yeah, they had
on.
they had Yeah, they had a priest lined up, you know, outside, you know, out in right center there in the concourse near Shea Bridge.
But the way the team was going in 2011.
That's awesome. That's very good, Sam. Very well done. Okay, so thank you, Justin, for the background. And, again, we very much appreciate having you. And on the subject of another individual player to talk about, let's talk a little about Michael Conforto. Now, he's starting to wake up a little bit, and that's good. But my question for you is partially, you know, what are you seeing with Michael Conforto on the field 2021? The other part of the question, and personally the part I'm more interested in, is do you think the Mets will bring this guy back? I mean, there's a lot to think about. You know, they've got the huge Lindor contract. Conforto is one of my favorite Mets. He was starting to smooth out the inconsistencies. He's kind of reverted back a little bit. So if you can comment on his on-field play, and then please give us some thoughts on, are you hearing anything about negotiations? Do you think they're bringing this guy back?
Yeah, okay. So first, on-field play, I mean, it to me, you know, I just chalked up his, you know, slow start to, like, your typical Michael Conforto slump, you know, it'll be over soon sort of thing. Pete Alonso said it, like, I think he said, what did he say? I think he said, you know, and, you know, at the end of the year, we'll just be laughing about this. And Luis Rojas felt like he'd get out of it. Now he's starting to come around. But when Michael Conforto talked about being off balance and, like, trying to, when he was struggling, he was trying to lean in a little further, and he was leaning towards, he was further on his front foot because he was trying to see the ball better. He wasn't seeing the ball very well, and that made a lot of sense to me. And that kind of, it clicked then, and he said that usually when he leans in like that, it's because he's trying to see the ball a lot better, and it's just like this natural habit, this instinct that he wants to get a better look at it, but it goes to him, you know, it leads to him instead being off balance, and that made a lot of sense. Now that he's been a little more on balance, he's started to come around, and you can see him look a little more relaxed up there, and I think the at-bats are a lot better as a whole. I mean, even, God, like that first series, the Philly series, the one day he left nine men on base, like he just looked lost. And I think now you can see him starting to find himself, and it's really starting to even out, like kind of the Michael Conforto we know. Now, in terms of negotiations, it doesn't seem like there's much on, you know, on that front right now, but I'm just going based off of what Sandy Alderson said back in, it was opening day, or well, the Mets is opening day now, but I don't think, you know, like there's no hard deadline for that. And that was what Zach Scott has said before, that he was under the impression that the only person who gave a hard deadline was Lindor. So things could theoretically start. On that note, I mean, and this is just me speculating here, when you've got a guy off to a slow start like that, you know, might demand a bigger price tag because he will probably be, you know, the best outfielder on the market, best, you know, all-around outfielder on the market. You know, and he's struggling like that. I mean, you might wait a little bit to see if, you know, things even out. And I think that's to get to your question of, are they going to bring him back? I certainly think they want to. I think they know it's important. Because look, I mean, he's a homegrown guy. Those guys prop up your roster, not only like for the fan base morale wise, but for the guys who have, you know, gotten to come up with him. And I just don't, I think he's good. Michael Conforto is a funny player because I think he gets so much ire from the fans for the streakiness. And I totally get it because there are times where his slump is just crippling. But he's not – on the other hand, if you look at all that he does and all that he means to them, not only as a right fielder but as, you know, the player rep, a leader in the clubhouse, he's not an easy guy to replace, guys. Like, I don't – and I think that part gets a little bit lost. Like, the overall package of Michael Conforto – isn't as easy to replace as some, you know, might believe. And I think that's got to be the driving factor. I think that's why I would guess, you know, they want him back and they're serious about wanting him back. Now it's going to be a matter of, you know, that price tag. If they're, especially with, you know, new ownership, like they're definitely not going to, you know, bend to his will. Like we saw, you know, they didn't really bend all the way toward Francisco Lindor's, you know, counteroffer. So I think, within reason, like, you know, but I do think they want him back because he's not an easy guy to replace. He does mean a lot, not only to the team, but to the franchise as a whole, to the fan base. I mean, you said it, like, he's, you know, one of your favorite Mets, but I just think you know, I mean, those it, it's going to be interesting, let's just say, to see how he performs the rest of the season in a contract year, because it's just you've seen these kind of scary, sketchy situations like Javi Baez going. I mean, Javi Baez has lost himself a lot of money already. And, you know, you kind of just hope the same thing doesn't really happen to Conforto.
Yeah, and that I was hoping for a different answer, but I appreciate the one you gave, because I was hoping to hear that there's some traction in negotiations. But if they're taking a wait-and-see approach, albeit, you know, that he might be difficult to replace for all the reasons you mentioned, both on the field and in terms of clubhouse presence being a homegrown Met and all of that, it seems to me like it's a bit up in the air. And I think it would be, although you did say that they would like to bring him back, I think it would be a huge mistake to let him go. And I hope they don't put too much stock in this one particular season. And I hope he actually turns it around to a point where if they do put stock in this season, he gives them a good one. His trend line is certainly pointing up. And with a quality hitter like that, you have to think it'll continue. So, Sam, your thoughts on Mr. Conforto, and would you like to have him back? Do you think he'll come back? Think they'll bring him back?
Well, other than the fact that Mike mentioned the magic word Carlos Beltran, and I very much wanted to go on a Carlos Beltran tangent, but I will hold off, even though I do have his baseball reference up. So whenever you guys are ready, I've got that going. We're talking about outfielders here. But when it comes to Michael Conforto, this guy should be an RBI machine, but he's an LOB machine. That's my problem right now. All I see, especially right now with everybody suffering, Michael Conforto is leaving way too many runners on. And I know this, like, you know, he mentioned the infamous game where he left 9 on. It started to happen again. This guy should be producing runs considerably, and he just continues to not do so. I know that he's going to end up doing it for another team, but maybe he's supposed to be the ones that falls into this, or they need to figure this thing out, because this is, like Mike says, you know, we've seen a pattern now, and he right now, unfortunately, can't, like, I understand the ire of Met fans. He is an LOB machine, way too streaky, and you can't just go off of last year, which was 60 games. It's both, like, I always, you know, I'm going to be a hypocrite, because I was also the one saying that, of course, it counts. It's what everybody was dealing with. But at the same time, I guess you got to pick and choose. And right now, considering, I think that it is a place, considering that the Mets weren't able to go anywhere last year, that you can say this still, you know, this still is the aberration. 2020 was the aberration. And right now, he just has a lot to prove to me that he doesn't keep leaving men on base before I give him a contract.
It's hard to argue that, as much as I would love to. So, Mike, where do you stand on this?
I'm kind of in lockstep with everybody else, Rich. I'm not seeing it. He's got 4 RBIs in 19 games this year. 3 of those came in the first 4 games. He has 1 run batted in over the last 15 games, and that's not this season. It's not last year's compromised season by COVID. It's his career. And it's not streaky, because that would imply something else. His highlights, his career highlights, are an aberration. He's never been the type of player or individual to carry this team for, say, 2 or 3 weeks at a time. He has yet to do that. You know, and his agent, Scott Boras, is going to complicate matters because, well, Scott Boras might be agreeable to negotiating a deal with the Mets before he hits the open market, because he is indeed struggling so badly. You know, and, Rich, I guess the problem is expectations. How low are they, or how high are they? You know, so what do we want from Conforto? In 2018, in the month of September, he drove in 29 runs in 28 games, including a stretch of 22 RBIs over 16 games. That's what we want. But he did that once, in 1 month, in 1 season. There was another time in 2019, in August, he drove in 23 runs in 27 games, including stretches of 7 RBIs in 3 games and 9 RBIs in 6 games. That's what we want. But that's isolated, again, to 1 month in one season. I need that over extended lengths of time. And he's just never provided that. So to be streaky is one thing. As Sam says, he's a left on base machine throughout his career. 2019, for the first time in his career, he averaged double digits RBIs in each of the months from April through September. Double digit RBIs for the first time in his career through September. Otherwise, you know, 12 RBIs in a month, 14 RBIs in a month. But he's never been the type to say, all right, guys, jump on my back. I'll carry you for 2 weeks. I've never seen it. And Rich, he's one of my favorites, too. And he's an unbelievably likable player. As Justin says, he's homegrown, you know, and we have an affinity towards those kinds of players. But I need more of the kind of production that I put forth. Of course, might be, you know, agreeable to negotiating something before he hits the open market because his client is indeed struggling.
It's a sobering conversation, and I do fear that Conforto's streakiness might be something they think about. And look, I know the Mets have a lot of money now with Steve Cohen, but money is a finite resource no matter who you are. Do they want to pay what Boris might be able to get for Conforto and have the Lindor contract and have DeGrom, who can opt out after next year, and start thinking about him a little bit? I worry that this might be our last year with Conforto, and that would suck. I mean, it would, because I know he's not perfect. I know that, but when he's hot, he's fantastic. I think he's an underrated defensive outfielder. And he's not great, but he's certainly good, and being homegrown. So we'll have to see how that one plays out. And speaking of homegrown Mets, Justin, I want to go here next. We'll continue our streak of talking about individual players, and we have to talk about Jacob DeGrom. You can't do a Mets podcast without talking about Jacob DeGrom and what he's been able to do, which is just otherworldly, in my opinion. You know, the way this guy goes out there and dominates. Now, he wasn't quite as dominating last night, but that was still most pitchers' A game. So here's my question for you. It's another two-parter, tapping into your insight, being close to the team. If you can give us some thoughts on DeGrom's body of work and what you're seeing, and if you have any kind of insight as to why this guy keeps throwing harder as he goes into his, you know, early to mid-30s, I'd love to hear that. But the thing I want to ask you about, I just kind of teased out. As we know, he can opt out after the 22 season. That's a real thing. And he puts a smile on his face and all that kind of stuff. After every game when they don't score, he takes personal accountability for everything. Do you think that there might come a point, from what you know Jacob DeGrom, where he says, you know what, I'm not going to let these guys potentially keep me out of the Hall of Fame. I'm out of here. I'm going to go somewhere else. Or do you think he's more of a loyalist? So if you can comment on his body of work, what you're seeing, but maybe give us some insight, if you can, what you might read in the tea leaves about what his intentions might be.
Yeah, so starting with the body of work, I mean, it's pretty surreal. Like, for me personally, like, I think I'm 24. I never got to see Seaver, Doc, you know, in person, live. But it's like, it's crazy to hear fans who did marvel, you know, who got to see those guys and the Koufaxes of their generation, guys like that, and they're now marveling at DeGrom. And that really tells you about where he is. In terms of the velocity, I mean, being able to hit 102, you know, here and there, but, you know, sitting 99, 100, 101. My best guess at this is that I think I remember asking him a question in spring about, like, when he felt that his career started to turn. And he said it was in 2018 when Dave Island told him to simplify things. And he said, Jacob DeGrom said,
"Did you know that
too?
Save you hundreds on car insurance and more. So what are you waiting for?
You know, like he said,
I was
trying to watch too much video. I was always overanalyzing things. I was picking apart every little thing I ever did." And then Dave Island told him to simplify things. And he said that simplification of his delivery really allowed him to repeat that delivery more and just get out there and throw. And I think, you know, that has something to do, you know, with the velocity. But really, if you think you could go back and say, you know, this guy was a shortstop, I think that's the biggest reason, right? Like, if he didn't grow up pitching X amount of innings every weekend, year round in travel ball showcases. Like, he didn't. He played shortstop. And this is a guy who he was really, when he was 23 years old, starting to learn how to pitch, his arm was fresh. And so now you look at him, you know, being 32, his age 33 season, he just doesn't have a lot of mileage on his arm. He's still figuring it out. Like, guys who, you know, nowadays might, you know, take a jump when they're 25, 26, he's taking that when he's 30, 31, 32 because he doesn't have the mileage on his arm. I think that's the biggest thing. And my sense of, you know, and I don't know his opt-out specifically, like, I haven't really, you know, like, we haven't heard from him about that since before spring training when he just said, you know, it was something he would just cross when he gets there. But, you know, I have talked to people who know him, you know, around him, and everything I've heard is that he is, like, my guess is that he is more of a loyalist. Now, that's not to say he wouldn't opt out. That's not me predicting that he stays. You know, he's a Met for his entire career. I just think he's a guy who, you know, if he wouldn't – somebody told me if he didn't do base, he'd probably be, like, farming. You know, that's what he enjoys. He likes riding his ATVs, his dirt bikes. You know, he grew up in DeLand, Florida. This isn't a guy from Miami or L.A. or New York. I mean, it's funny because his personality is probably the exact opposite of New York. Likeable guy. Fans love him, but he doesn't like the spotlight, you know. But he's a great teammate. He's a guy who likes to joke around. He loves the guys. But I think my intuition there is just more that he is, you know, a loyalist, because that's all that I've heard about him is that you mentioned the scenario you set up is like he starts thinking like, you know, like I'm not going to let these guys keep me from getting in the Hall of Fame. Everybody's got personal goals, right? He set that the Hall of Fame as a personal goal. He set Cy Young's as a personal goal. But I just, everything that I glean from him and those who know him is that, like, while he cares about that stuff, this guy wants to win. Like, he cares about winning. He cares about, and he's, you know, grateful to be in the position he's in more than anything, because there was a time when he played for Stetson that he was riding the bench. He was the last guy on the bench. And so, like, you know, he's grateful to be in the position that he's in. And I see him more as kind of a loyal guy. He's not somebody that you're – I would be very, very surprised if he leaves and then you end up seeing him, like, trashing the Mets or something like that, or saying, yeah, you know, I had to get out. I just – that's just not – I don't think that's ever been him. Like, I don't – you know, I don't know him as well as his friends and family do, you know, and I don't know him at all, like, on a personal level like that. But from talking to people around him, like, he strikes me as more the type that he truly isn't mad about that stuff. It's not just an act.
Well, that's good to hear. And so, Sam, if you can comment on DeGrom's body of work, and I guess what would your reaction be if he ever did opt out? Like, do you think that can really happen? How would you take that?
No, you know, it's kind of a thing where, like, David Wright came up in my head when we were just talking about it, thinking about how no matter what the Mets – how much the Mets just – held him back from, you know, I mean, he very well, other than the fact that he injured it on what was clearly a play that you can injure something like that on, who knows what they could have done with what David Wright could have done, what anybody could have done. I'm going back to Carlos Beltran here. Who knows what anybody could have done without the Wilpons handling the injuries. And so, you know, DeGrom doesn't necessarily fall into that, but it's the first thing that came to my mind was David Wright. And I think that Jacob DeGrom will stay loyal. And I do believe in the idea that because he was a shortstop at first, I think somebody, you know, mentioned that, you know, he I forget exactly who put this out there, but talking about how he never pitched in high school. He never pitched in Little League, really, you know? This was all developed at the later levels. And that, I think, I hold a lot of credence to, that there could be a lot of pitches left in DeGrom. And the Mets better not screw it up. You know, what would I do? I'd have to deal with it just like I dealt with watching every Met, ex-Met, destroy the team. But I don't think that it just – something feels that he will finish his career as a Met, that he won't stop until he brings himself a world championship, till he brings his team a world championship, and till he brings himself to the Hall of Fame in a Mets cap.
That would be the ideal outcome. So, Mike, as I go to you, I'm going to tweak the question, and I think you know where I'm going with this. I put something out on my Mesmerized Online thing about what was more of an event. And I know, Justin, this predates you, and Sam, it predates you too. A Gooden start in 1985 or a DeGrom start this year. And it was very interesting. I got hundreds of responses on that. And, Mike, if you can comment on DeGrom's body of work, but also I know you were pretty active in that debate too. Just for those fans who are around in 85, give us your thoughts on a DeGrom start today versus a Gooden start then.
Insofar as those two answers for you specifically. This present Mets team in these pandemic conditions and the lack of crowds versus the 1980s crowds and that raucous Mets team completely complicates the answer. It's so difficult to compare the two because of the conditions. Then again, you know, that we had high expectations for that 80s teams, and, you know, our expectations have been tempered somewhat with this present-day Mets team. The other answer I had specifically to that question was Doc was never better than 1984 through 1986, whereas Jacob DeGrom is getting better by the season. And, you know, what he's doing this year is bucking all kinds of trends, and he's either performing at a career high, doing something at a career low, another thing at a career best, but everything that he's doing this season is the best he's ever done it, you know, in or throughout his career. But, you know, Rich, we saw Seaver at the tail end of his Mets career. You know, I have a lot of memories from 74, 75, 76, and obviously in 77, Steve Henderson trade, as Sam likes to say. And, you know, in comparing the two, I just don't. And I suggested folks look at Tom Seaver's baseball card and behold how his career record is populated with numbers in bold and italic or both. And it speaks to his greatness above and beyond his Hall of Fame contemporaries, and that he retired third on the all-time strikeouts list. That's how you judge Tom Seaver. And, you know, it would be wrong to judge the two pitchers from two different eras. I would only, you know, judge DeGrom according to his contemporaries and how he stacks up and how his record compares to his fellow ball players in the end. You know, if it's good enough to get into the Hall of Fame, you know, bless him. But presently, you know, Seaver had 9 straight seasons of 200-plus strikeouts. DeGrom is in his 8th year with the Mets. So we still have quite a bit of a career to go. But we know what DeGrom has been doing has just been phenomenal. Rich, he won the Rookie of the Year. In 2015, he tied Seaver's record. Postseason record with 13 strikeouts in a game. 2 Cy Youngs. He's only the 11th pitcher in history to win back-to-back Cy Youngs. And he's the only other pitcher besides Tom Seaver to win it twice while donning a Mets uniform. Let's not forget his record of 30 straight games, three runs or less, a major league record. What this guy has done throughout his career has been just off the charts, really off the charts. During that streak, 21. Let me see if I get this straight. You know what? Skip that. I think I've said enough. It's just incredible. I will say with certainty over his two Cy Young seasons, the opposition, he limited the opposition to just two runs or less in 51 of 64 starts. That's over his two Cy Young seasons. Two runs or less in 51 of 64 starts. That's crazy. That's crazy. And presently he's throwing his fastball at an all-time high and using it at an all-time high. And he's deviated away from his slider and changeup. He's yet to throw a curveball. And like I said, this season he's bucking all kinds of trends that he set over the last 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years. Incredible.
Truly is. All right, so I have one more question. We're nearing the end, and thank you to everyone for listening to the Metsian podcast. And, of course, thank you to Justin Toscano, our special guest this evening. And, Justin, I'd like to start with you on my last question for the night. Then we have one more from Sam. And that, I want to take it off the Mets. I think we've talked about them, you know, quite a bit over the last hour and 20 minutes. I'd like to talk about Major League Baseball as a whole. I was very encouraged this week by the report that came out that the negotiations toward a new CBA have begun. Now, obviously, it was a first negotiation, but that's something that I have to say has been on my mind because the two sides have – there's such acrimony right now. And my concern was that if they wait until after the season, and I thought for sure, and maybe this could still happen, that we were going to see some kind of a work stoppage and some kind of a delay and, you know, and God forbid a cancellation of the 2022 season, but that's the way my brain works. But I am encouraged to hear that at least they're talking now. So my question to you is, obviously it's very early. Do you get the sense that they realize they can't do this? They cannot have a work stoppage. Let me throw something else out there. This week it came out that for the most recent 18-day period had the highest viewership on the MLB.tv app in the history of the app, which goes back to 2001. Viewership is up for Sunday Night Baseball 38%. Local viewership for a lot of the local teams on their local networks is up as well. So my point is fans are interested. Fans are watching all of that. Hopefully coming out of a pandemic, it would be incredibly tone deaf of this sport to shut itself down next year because they're going to bicker, and you know they're going to bicker publicly. So do you think with all that circulating, the cooler heads will prevail and they're going to hammer this thing out and have a nice trophy to wave around that, you know, we figured this out, no interruption next year, or am I just being overly optimistic?
No, I see the same thing. And that's just coming from, you know, not any special insight that anybody else doesn't have. But I think for me, like, I look back at the most recent reference point, which was the 2020 season. When push came to shove, they got something done. They played baseball 60 games, did a whole expanded postseason, all of these new, like, seven-inning doubleheaders, put together that whole, you know, health manual to keep players safe and protected during the season. The same thing is going to happen here. They understand there cannot be a work stoppage. They understand what the, you know, that strike, you know, 94 did to the game. And they've seen those numbers too. They know baseball isn't dead right now. They've got some of the best collection of young stars, you know, in the game, from, you know, Juan Soto to Fernando Tatis to Ronald Acuña Jr. to, you know, Francisco Lindor, who's even, you know, not old yet. Like, they have talent that is marketable, that is able to be branded, that people enjoy watching, talent that, you know, in this day and age, guys like Jacob DeGrom, you know, throwing 100 miles an hour, relievers throwing 100, you know, almost 100. I mean, it's they cannot afford a work stoppage, and I think they know that. That's why I expect cooler heads to prevail, because I just think at the end of the day, they're going to find they know that a work stoppage would be destructive for both sides. And if that's the only common ground they can find, like you said, they will bicker public. Think that's a given. If you're in Vegas right now, put your money on that. But the only common ground between these two might be that they both know a work stoppage would be very detrimental to the sport and its progress, and the kind of the catch up it's trying to play with the other major American sports. And I, you know, if that's the only common ground they have, so be it. But I think that common ground alone is just going to, like you said, maybe I'm optimistic, but I just don't, I do not see them into a work stoppage. They will bicker plenty, but I'm prepared for a normal 2022 and beyond.
That's awesome. And let me say this too. I read this as well. I thought this was fascinating that if Major League Baseball players accepted the owner's proposal to delay everything by a month, the season would have started right around, you know, like April 24th or whatever it might have been. This concept they threw out, let the vaccinations kick in and all that, and let the COVID thing start to wane. And if they had accepted that proposal and started in late April, for the statistics I gave you, plus a couple others that I don't remember, April has been an incredible month for baseball in terms of viewership, like I said. But there are a couple of other things in the article I read, too, that pointed to what a great month this was for Major League Baseball. And that month would not have happened if the Players Association had accepted the proposal to delay the season by a month and maybe tack on 2 weeks at the end and end up with like 154 games or something. So interesting to think about. I'll just open that up to Sam and Mike. If you guys just want to jump in, you know, if you have any thoughts on the CBA and can they be that tone deaf to have a work stoppage?
I believe
I
they can be, Rich.
I don't see it happening as well.
Mike says it can be because they have been, right, Mike?
That's right.
Go ahead, Mike.
But,
go ahead.
But more so than that, Rich, bargaining rules the day. You know, it's always, well, if you want this, what am I getting in return? That's just, you know, union ownership. That's the relationship when it comes to collective bargaining. Has less to do with baseball than it does business. These are long-term decisions. And the owners, they don't do anything, you know, if there's not a profit involved. Whereas the union, one of their main goals is to make sure that the person with the least wherewithal gets the most. So it's tricky. It's tricky. And again, it's collective bargaining, and you have to compartmentalize when it gets down to the nitty gritty.
Sam, any
thoughts on this? I would just, yeah, jumping in. I mean, like, I just think that regardless of, you know, how stupid they've been before, you know, this might have kind of been dealt with because of 2020 and because of the fact that they had to negotiate then. They might have gotten all the ill will out then, and that is why they're going to get it done now.
I certainly hope so. And to me, if around, you know, 4th of July-ish, you know, August 1st-ish, whatever it is, they could say, hey, you know what, we're having a great year. We've got a lot of young talent, as Justin mentioned, and ratings are up. And by the way, folks, we've just signed a new 5-year agreement. That's going to go – that'll have a big impact. Because I think we as baseball fans, we're just sick of the acrimony. We're sick of the airing of the dirty laundry publicly. And I really think for this sport more than any other, waving a piece of paper on TV and saying we have an agreement, you know, 5 more years of baseball uninterrupted, it would mean more than in the NBA, the NFL, NHL, because of the acrimony and the history. Okay, thank you for that. And Justin, again, thank you for joining us tonight, but we do have one more question Sam wanted to ask before we wrap. So, Sam, I think we've got a question for Justin.
Well, Justin, you know, I've spent more time than I expected to ever really spend in New Jersey over the last few years driving Lyft. And so my question for you is not just, you know, coming from San Diego, coming to New York, but have you spent – you know, you're working for a New Jersey paper, and just looking, I've been doing research here, and it says it's founded in 1895. So I'm wondering if you've you know, done a little poking around in the history of the paper, and what is your perception of New Jersey? Do you have you before the COVID situation, were you working over in Woodland Park where the paper is, and do you also live in Jersey?
That's a good question. I guess I'll go in order there. I haven't really done much poking around on just like the history. I guess maybe I could. Like, I hear things, you know, from colleagues. I see things that get shared, you know, around the newsroom, at least virtually. But yeah, kind of just, I don't know. Maybe that's just, I just try to stick to my job. Now, history, I'm a big history buff, so that interests me. But I guess I haven't really thought about poking around at a lot of the history. Like, you know, I do know some of the former like sports reporters just because, you know, I'm in that world. So that kind of, you know, that does interest me. I might have to start poking around a little bit more. To go down the line, though, on the question, I haven't spent, even pre-pandemic, I've only been in New Jersey twice, actually. So, okay, three times. So that, like, when I was driving into New York the first time to move here, and let's see, that second time just to go into the office to do some onboarding. But I've never, like, I don't work in the office just because I'm just wherever the Mets are. And so that's, like, the thing I really liked about it was, you know, when I was in college, man, I was like, I don't want some 9-to-5 job. You know, like, that's why I did this, you know, in the first place. It's like, gets me on my feet. I think, you know, working a 9-to-5 job for me for 2 years would probably age me by 60 years by that third year. So it's, yeah, I've never really had to go into the office. I could just work from the ballpark, work from home, work from the hotel, wherever I am. And so I live in New York. Yeah. I live in Forest Hills, Queens. So, yeah, so I don't even live in the city. I wanted to be somewhere a little closer to the ballpark just to make my commute a little more bearable. And I like, I don't have a problem with it, you know, in the city in Manhattan, but I like kind of having a little bit of my own space and, being able to relax, especially cause my job is like so much dealing with people. And I do like that. I mean, I like talking to people. I like being around people, but it's, yeah, it's nice to be, I like the spot a lot, but yeah, my perception of Jersey, to cap that off, I feel like Jersey gets a bad rap from people around the country, and I don't really get it, because, like, the times I've been there has been, like, nice, like, that one time to go to the office, and then another time I went to Keene University to speak to a journalism class there, taught by another person at our company, so, like, I just feel like it's nice. Like, I don't know. I mean, the suburbs look nice. I mean, it looks like somewhere you could raise a family. And I think for me, like, that's certainly stuff I think about. I mean, I'm not, like, 35. You know, I'm only 24. But it's stuff I notice. The food looks good. You know, it looks like a lot of the same stuff. And I don't know. I think it just gets a bad rap because maybe it's right next to New York City. And it's, you know, obviously not New York City. But it I didn't have a problem with it. It's just a little bit of a – I didn't live there because it was going to be just a little bit too much of a pain going back and forth, you know, daily, because baseball is such a daily grind. So I need to be a little closer. But, yeah, that's that history part intrigues me. I might have to start poking around a little bit more.
And we can do an entire podcast about the bad rep Jersey gets, not only around the country but also – in the tri-state area. Rich, go ahead.
All right. Well, Mike, unless you have anything else for Justin, we can wrap it up.
I have one more quick question. Justin, you wrote about Brendan Nimmo receiving a shot in his right hip due to an impingement. Should we be expecting more innings played by Kevin Pillar and Albert Almora in the near future?
Only if things go south. So Brendan Nimmo last weekend against the Nationals played through that painful hip, and he said, I think his exact words were, you know, with modern medicine, we have painkillers nowadays, which is kind of a scary thing to hear, but he got through it on painkillers. But this shot is supposed to be more of a long-term solution, and the reason he's encouraged is because in 2018, he mentioned having, you know, a similar issue, but with his left hip, and once he received the injection, he was fine, you know, and hasn't felt it since. So they're expecting this, you know, the athletic training staff and the team doctors and Nimmo are expecting this to be the long-term solution for him. If things go south, you know, I would expect more of Pillar and Almora. But for now, I think, and you can even maybe expect more of them in the future just because of the schedule, you know, is going to be a little more packed. But I think Nimmo, you know, looks like he it seems like he feels good and he's pretty optimistic. So I think there's no reason to worry there yet.
I'm good, Rich.
You know, one, Justin, I know I said I promise is my last question. Can you help me understand why when they want a righty outfielder, particularly in center, they seem to prefer Pilar over Almora? And, yes, I know he made the great catch. I happened to be at that game. It was wonderful. But Pilar just does not seem to add much. And Almora just seems like a better – why do they so prefer Pilar seemingly?
I don't know. That's been something that I like – I mean, that I've wanted to ask about. I mean, you know, things – other stories and things and questions take precedence sometimes, but, you know, then two backup outfielders. But it is something that to me is curious because I don't – like, Pilar definitely had a great spring, you know. So I saw it, you know, into the season. I mean, God, did I have him – you know, did I have Kevin Pillar, you know, taking the first AB of the season for the 2021 Mets on my bingo card? No. But yeah, I don't know. I think to me it does seem like at this point, you know, Pillar's an experienced guy, but Almora, even if he struggled those, you know, last few years, especially in Chicago after that World Series, I mean, we've already seen him in limited time make an impact with that great catch, you know, on the ball Kyle Schwarber hit. And then we saw, you know, we've seen him run the bases, go, I think, you know, that one game in Colorado, you know, be a pinch runner and be valuable there. So even in very limited time, I mean, he's been valuable. So I don't – that's something that else that's curious to me. And, yeah, I might have to ask about that just because I don't really know. I mean, I'm kind of as confused as everybody else. Like, is it a huge difference? You know, is Pilar worse than Almora? Maybe not. Is Almora better than Pilar? Maybe not. I just don't think, like, to me, the gap isn't drastic enough to have seen Pilar as much as we have over Almora, if that makes sense.
Oh, maybe. And Rich, two intangibles right there, whether it be the pinch running or the defensive gem right there. Two things that we were talking about the game getting away from, and that's maybe one of the reasons why they're not using Almora.
Could be. I don't know. But it seems to me like, personally, after he made that catch, I would have started the next day just as a reward. And I'm saying that bit of hyperbole there. But I just don't understand why, you know, okay, Nimmo's hip is acting up, plus, you know, there's a lefty on the mound perhaps, so we're going to go with Pilar. It's like, Louis, let me introduce you to Almora. This guy, see that guy there wearing number four? Him. Can you play him? I don't understand. You know, I don't get it. All right. Well, I think that's everything we have for you, Justin. And Justin, I'm being candid when I say this. You've been fantastic. This has been a wonderful conversation. It's been wonderful talking to you. We enjoy your work. You know, I listen to you every night in the pre and post and the questions you ask. And if you could just remind folks one more time where you do your primary work and where they can find you on Twitter, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, so northjersey.com, and then Twitter is Justin C. Toscano, just my name with a C in the middle of it.
Fantastic. And what we do, Justin, is we usually wrap these shows up with a last word, which is never a word, usually it's a couple of words, but just something you want to leave people thinking about or a final comment you want to make. We'll do you third here so you have a chance to see how this works. It's usually just a couple of sentences. So we'll start with Sam. So, Sam, as the CEO of Podcasting Operations, what is your last word?
Well, besides mentioning, let's go Zach Wilson, how about you don't mess it up again, Jets? So let's just throw that out there on draft night. But really quickly, just because Mike mentioned Carlos Beltran within the Lindor conversation, and of course, you know, what's so funny about 2005 was that he was an all-star, even though I can see the numbers were underwhelming, as I remember them being. But my question for you, Rich, real quick, is at 27-25, when it comes to the amount of hits Carlos Beltran had and 435 homers, could he have done more, let's say, hit those specific Hall of Fame numbers, 3,000 and 500, had it not been for the Wilpons?
Wow, that's a great question. And the first place my head goes when I hear that is the microfracture surgery, right? The fact that they messed with the guy like they did with Lowry.
So would he have been in better playing condition if that had been played differently? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure that the gap could have been closed by a Wilpon management issue. I think his gap there is a little bigger than that, but I think it's a great question. I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I'll just throw it out there that that's 275 hits. Mike, I'll pass it to you next. Looking at that, he probably could have made it up somewhere.
Sure. Let's not forget that he had his best seasons, best career seasons, and his best individual season in a Mets uniform. So he certainly could have done more if conditions and decisions were made in a more, what shall we say, a more responsible manner. I agree with you, Sam. The numbers could have been better. Could have been. But by how much? That's debatable. That's debatable. But again, the strength in the argument is what did he accomplish after that season? And he did a lot. That 206 season was just outstanding. Let's also not forget his relationship with the fans. That first season, he didn't perform, you know, up to snuff as far as we were concerned. And he had a bad, he got off to a bad start with the fans. And then he performed through the charts. And then when he got hurt again with that knee and the way it was going down and performance and effectiveness, you know, that the relationship soured again. So there was an interesting dynamic with Beltran, and, you know, it didn't seem to stop in the previous offseason, did it?
No. No. All right, so, Sam, was that your last word, or do you have a nice juicy one for
us? No, that's my last word. J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets, Jets. And Carlos Beltran, and I know that sometimes it does come up with Carlos Beltran, whether he should get another chance as Alex Cora had, but that's, a conversation for another day.
Very good. Mike, what would be your last word for tonight?
Let's go Mets. April showers being May flowers. So I hope next month is better because I'd like to be going into the summer, at least partly above, you know, halfway up the high ground. You know what I mean?
I do. All right, so Justin, is there a final thought you'd like to leave with the audience this evening? And once again, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'll pull out a quote. So last night when I was trying to sum up how I felt about this team, I came across this quote from, you know, the late Kobe Bryant. That still feels weird to say. But going back to my Southern California roots, that was a guy I idolized. He once said, "Winning takes precedence over all. There's no gray area, no almost." And that's exactly how I feel about this team. While we've discussed them in nuance and using context over this podcast, the final line that the results are results, right? And so they're going to need to win, or none of these excuses, none of this context matters. And I think, you know, like fans especially, like, believe that, and they're not wrong for it.
Thank you
shout
for
out
sharing
to
that quote.
Twitter. Right. And a shout out to Mets Twitter, right?
Right. Thank you for sharing that, Justin. I think that really is where the rubber hits the road. So thank you to everyone listening. Thank you to our, you know, faithful audience of live listeners and people who download it. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Mike, my co-conspirators in podcasting. And once again, a special thank you to Mets beat writer Justin Toscano for this wonderful conversation tonight. And with that said, Justin, stay well, stay safe, and enjoy Philadelphia. And that's it for us. So have a great night, everyone, and thanks for listening. Bye now.
Good night, all.
Let's go, Mets. Thanks, Justin.